Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review. I'm Ben Rylan, and it is that time of the year again where Europe explodes into a glittery bonanza of song and dance. All pretentiousness goes out the window, but politics are still very much on people's minds. It can only be Eurovision, of course. On the show today, we are dedicating the next 45 minutes to the international competition that has upwards of 200 million people congregating around television sets all over the world. This year's event is taking place in Kiev after the Ukrainians took home the prize last year with their entry by Jamala. I'll be joined by experts and enthusiasts on the matter, including our very own Eurovision guru, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Do stay tuned. Well, I'm joined in the studio today by Fernando, but we also have with us Chris West, the author of Eurovision, A History of Modern Europe Through the World's Greatest Song Contest, and Francis Robinson, who's written about Eurovision for everyone from Politico to the Wall Street Journal. Welcome, everyone, to the studio today.
Thank you.
Now, we should start by saying that we're recording this part of the show on the Tuesday before Eurovision starts, so we don't actually know yet exactly who is in the final, as the semi-finals are still going to take place, of course. Today's show will actually progress through the week, so it'll be a bit of a countdown of sorts towards the big day itself. But let's start with you, Chris, because you've written this book about the history of Eurovision, but you've actually worded it as a history of Europe through the world's greatest song contest. Maybe you want to take us back then to the beginnings of the contest itself. How did it all come about?
Well, it really starts at the end of the Second World War with this passionate desire by a lot of people in Europe that this should never happen again, that the countries of Europe should not go to war in such a vicious fashion again. The main result of that was what's now the EU, was initially a coal and steel community and then became the European Economic Community, or the Common Market as it was known, which was six nations. Eurovision was actually came from the similar idea. It was, let's get everybody singing together and perhaps we won't kill each other. And Marcel Bezençon, who was the founder, the man who came up with the idea, was a very close friend of Jean Monnet, who was a great philosopher of European integration. So they got the kind of same sort of roots, and they came out about the same time. The first Eurovision was in 1956, and the Treaty of Rome, with its interesting phrase, ever closer union, was signed in 1957. So they're not exactly time twins, but they're siblings with a very close birth date.
When we talk to people about Eurovision, sometimes, you know, everyone has a bit of a different opinion as to how seriously we should be allowed to take Eurovision. Is it all just a bit of fun, or can it actually have a serious impact on the way Europe operates politically as well? Francis, where do you think it fits in for you?
I suppose the first thing to say is it's definitely really, really popular in Brussels. The first year that I moved there, it got to Eurovision time, and I'd only been living there for about a fortnight, and I was like, oh no, where am I going to watch the song contest? Where shall I go? So I went to this pub in the middle of town called Kitty O'Shea's. It's an Irish pub, and I went in, and just the atmosphere was amazing. It was the year that Lordi won for Finland, and I ended up watching it, you know, with Greek, Spanish, like all these different crowds, everybody cheering on their acts, and there was just this incredible feeling of, isn't it great that we're having this friendly rivalry through song rather than other means.
Fernando, how does that sit for you then? A friendly rivalry through song. Not entirely friendly this year, though, is it? The political undertones have always been there, regardless of what's happening in Europe. But with tensions from Russia in much of Europe at the moment, it really couldn't be more near the surface this year, could it?
Of course, I think Eurovision, it is a political contest. And as you mentioned, today especially because the Russian entry was banned to go to Ukraine. But I have to admit, you know, for me especially, and it's funny that Francis said, because my first Eurovision was the year that I moved to London. I was watching when Lordi won for Finland. I think it's an excuse to celebrate like a camp extravaganza event. I mean, it's one day in the year that you're allowed to do that, you know. I would compare to a World Cup of football. I don't actually see the difference. It's an excuse to have some fun. And I love how Eurovision is very open. I think it has so many lessons for Europe, especially in a time where the far right is there's a resurgence of the far right. And they're accepting of new countries, including your very own, Ben, Australia.
Indeed. very happy that Australia is back in there again. And it should be noted that Australia has actually done very well with who they've selected
for Eurovision this year. He's another contestant from one of those X Factor style shows, but he also happens to be very young. He was only 17 when he was on that television program. He's also openly gay and Indigenous. He's an Indigenous Australian, which is not something that we see on the national stage in Australia at all. So fantastic that he'll be representing Australia this year. Isaiah Firebrace, of course.
And again, diversity is political.
Well, diversity is political in a way.
When we talk about Conchita Wurst, you know, when she won for Austria, of course, it was a fun track. You know, I love her costume, but it is a political act. In a lot of countries, you know, especially here in Western Europe, we say, oh, we don't care, whatever she is. But a lot of countries still have a lot of prejudice, you know. So I think it's a good thing about Eurovision.
Absolutely. And the tagline, of course, is celebrating diversity. The Kiev Post sort of took a bit of a wallop against that idea recently with an editorial that said, celebrating conformity, ? Now, there have been a few objections placed, especially at Ukraine, with their welcoming of Eurovision, because, of course, it is all supposed to be about celebrating diversity, but not all nations are as willing to maybe send that point home as others. Australia, of course, as I mentioned there, are sending someone who very much does represent diversity. There's not much diversity from the forefront of a country like Ukraine, though, where being LGBT is not necessarily as easy as it is in many parts of the world. Do you think Eurovision actually does have a place in promoting real, authentic diversity in countries where it may not be so easy for that to happen at any other time of the year? Chris, what are your thoughts on that?
Yes, I think very much so. I mean, it goes back to the thing, it is political in the broader sense. I think it sends a very clear message. A lot of countries want to be European, and part of that is accepting diversity. We saw that in the past when, I think it was Slovenia, selected some gay artists. I can't remember which year it was. I should know, but I've forgotten. And then there were protests by sort of right-wing groups in Slovenia, and the television company pulled the act, Sestre. And then more people protested. And in Europe, people said, no, you've got to put these people in. This is not being European, taking them out for this reason. This is wrong. And they were reinstated. And I think that sent a very clear message about what it means to be European.
Absolutely.
That was serious. It's fun, but there's also always serious stuff in the background.
It does tend to get very serious because, I mean, Francis, it is all well and good to say, look, it's just a song contest, and as Fernando put it, you know, it is a time for everyone to celebrate and get together. But can we separate those two things? Can we look at Eurovision and say, oh, look what it does for European relations, look what it does for European politics, it forces people to come together that would otherwise be separate, but then it's also just a bit of fun? I mean, it's not really just a bit of fun, is it? It always comes with some sort of serious element.
No, exactly. And I think what's very interesting is the way that it's kind of gradually changed over the decades from that being maybe something that was accepted as coming along with it. And now in the last few years, you know, I went to a conference on Eurovision a couple of years ago, organised by the EBU, that the organisers have become much more interested in portraying that side of it as well, and it's a tool as a part of political soft power. So yeah, and I guess returning to the kind of gay rights thing, if you look at the winning entry from 1961, Nous les Amoureux, this is actually a kind of song of gay liberation, right? If you read the lyrics now, if you listen to it, it's like, it's really obvious what this was about, but at the time maybe that was more of a hidden message, you know, I don't think everybody appreciated that. Whereas now, if you look at Ukraine, they've got this big concrete rainbow put up in the corner of town, people are aware that that is part of what comes with hosting, and it just depends how much cities want to embrace that. When they were in Vienna, they had same-sex couples on the traffic lights, which I thought was very cute.
I remember that. It was such a nice touch to it, actually.
But what about the longer-lasting impact of that, though? When once Eurovision is there, of course, it's in Kiev, it's in various different cities every year. You know, everyone comes to town. Fernando, you're going to Kiev. There'll be a lot of people from all over Europe, all over the world there, you know, celebrating in all sorts of different outfits. Diversity will be very much on display, but then everyone packs up and goes home. Do you think it does have some sort of longer-lasting impact, or do we all sometimes a little bit guilty of putting all the focus on a city like Kiev and then just sort of forgetting about it?
Well, of course, you know, when people leave, people not pay attention, but I think it can have a huge impact. And, you know, again, I'm going to return to Conchita Wurst win. Even though I believe this was like 2-3 years ago, people are still talking about it. You know, she's still a well-known face outside Austria as well. So, and for a country like, you know, as we mentioned, Ukraine is not the best country in the world for LGBT rights. So even even if people leave and people don't talk about it, just the fact that this matter is being discussed, it's already something, in my opinion. And I would like to go back, I remember when Serbia, when they had their first entry on Eurovision, it was actually a winning track, and the singer, she was lesbian, and Serbia was, of course, coming after so many horrible years of war. So it was so relevant for Serbia, actually. Even our correspondent, Guy Deloney, wrote a lovely piece about the song and how it means a lot for Serbians, even though it's been a decade since it won.
Well, let's talk about then how those politics then fit into the voting process, because that's all that always plays a part, doesn't it? So given the political makeup of Europe at the moment, how is that going to inform how people vote? It's impossible to escape, especially what happened with that Russian contestant now not being allowed to take part because she had performed in Crimea back in 2015. So this is going to be something on people's minds when those voting tallies are coming in. Francis, what do you think the result is going to be? What's going to be on people's minds, aside from just whether they like the song?
Well, obviously the song should be the first thing. And I also have quite strong feelings about quite political entries, which is that I'm not the biggest fan of them.
Really?
Yeah, like last year with Jamala, right? Song 1944. They say, look, all right, fine, it's actually about the past. It's about 1944. But I think we all knew that it was really about now. And I just feel like if you're going to go and try and make your point that way, it's a bit clumsy. It's also not really the spirit of the rules, say, you know, no political statements in the lyrics. So it's a bit of a controversial one, but I find the politics of it absolutely fascinating, but I think those sort of 3 minutes on stage should just be pure and about the performance in a way. So for a start, there's that aspect. Then there's this question of political voting. Do people vote for Neighbours? Yes. Do people vote enthusiastically for their diaspora? Yes. But also now, since 2009, there are juries again, and there are lots of safeguards in place to make sure that it reflects kind of the merits of the song as well.
Chris, how much does the political stuff really impact people's voting decisions? If there is a song that people really, really, really love, but it's coming from an incredibly unpopular country in Europe that year for whatever reason, is there ever going to be a song as popular enough that really appeals to people enough to overcome those other sorts of things that come into people's decision making?
So you're saying, is Britain ever going to win the Eurovision Song Contest? Right. I must take up slightly, Francis. There's always been politics in Eurovision. You go back to Portugal's marvellous songs in the early 70s, which were wonderful criticisms of the Estado Novo regime. They were marvellous. And then there was that one was used as a sort of secret signal to start the revolution in 1974. The job of the EBU is to try and sort of keep it under control. And 1944, you could say, OK, they got it a bit wrong, but it's a judgment call. You can't just take it out. So there was that we don't want a Putin thing in 2009. OK, that had to go. That was a little on the obvious
side. What a brilliant song that was, actually.
It was wonderful.
We don't want a Putin.
Absolutely. I mean, great song, but it was a little bit too political, so that had to go. But I think this kind of nibbling at the boundaries thing is fun, actually. And I thought 1944 was okay. And yes, okay, there's politics in it, but I think that's all part of the game. Yeah, sorry, I've wandered completely off the subject, but this is about a good song from an obscure country. Yeah, I think people will vote for beautiful songs. We're seeing that from this year. We've got Italy and Portugal, two really popular songs. People don't hate them, but they haven't got a block like some of these countries. They're just there. They've come up with two cracking songs, and I think they're going to do really well.
I found it quite surprising when Russia was up against Ukraine and we weren't really sure who was going to win, because Russia did quite well that year. It's astonishing, though, isn't it? Because you would imagine that Russia in Europe would be quite unpopular, because, of course, they were famously booed as well, but the score was actually quite high. So it's not... Maybe the end result is, you know, a good song with a great performance can actually win out.
It looked great, right? Last year's Russia song. You know, look, I also find ballads a bit dull, frankly. So I was loving it. You know, he had this like high-tech production. He was sort of interacting with the animatronic backdrop. Swedish songwriters absolutely go in there and get the job done with these huge dance songs. I personally preferred it. But then, you know, is it about the politics? That's what it comes down to in the final analysis.
Well, I think maybe some people preferred the song. I mean, you know, I like the more haunting, slower song. I don't know. It wasn't just politics v aesthetics, and there was an aesthetic judgment as well.
Yeah.
We have to put things into context as well, because I was there, and of course Russia was going to be booed, because you have to be honest, I think the type of people that go to Eurovision to see on stage, you know, we're talking about the LGBT presence of Eurovision. To be fair, I think there are many people that stay at home and watch. And it's not only the LGBT community, but the people that travel to see the show, there's a very, very large percentage of them. So, of course, what Russia is doing to gay rights, of course, is going to be booed. But I don't think that's the what your average TV viewer of Eurovision was thinking, actually, in my opinion.
Indeed, indeed. Because as we're trying to get to the bottom of here, it can't just be about politics. It needs to have a larger vision than that. I mean, we need to talk about what the favourite to win is then, because I have to say it's definitely my favourite to win as well. So Italy is the favourite to win. Their entry is called Occidentali's Karma, and it's by Francesco Gabbani. Let's hear a little clip. Okay, so that is Occidentali's Karma by Francesco Gabbani. It is the favourite to win. I was going to ask, why do you think it's the favourite to win? Obviously because it's such a great song, am I right?
I think it's a very clever song as well. The lyrics are incredibly clever, and they're a subtle sort of wry take on the West's sort of sudden obsession with Eastern philosophy and things. It's a clever song. It's a great song. He sings it well. It's a great tune. Drives along beautifully. But there's a lot of thought in there as well. This is not Ding Dingy Dong. We've moved on. You know.
My take on why Måns Zelmerlöw did so well at the competition was because he had a great song. He's very attractive, and he was up there on stage, really utilizing the whole stage, and you know, really making theatre out of what he was performing. He understood about it being an all-rounded performance. It's not just a good song. It's not just a good performance. It's actually everything, and he gave the personality with it too. Fernando, what are your thoughts on how much of a stage presence you really need to be?
It's certainly not only about the song. You do need a good performance. And from what I see, to be honest, I didn't know Francesco Gabbani before this track, but I believe he won the Festival Sanremo twice. So I think he's quite used. He's not like a young artist. He's not only in his 20s. I believe he's in his mid-30s or something like that. He's very charismatic. I've been looking at some interviews. So I think I can see that he's going to win, and I definitely want to be in Rome next year as well. I think it's time. It's time for Italy to win.
It absolutely is time for Italy to win. And not just that, Francis. I'm sorry, but Italy has had some really shocking entries in the past few years. I mean, it's about time, I think, that they've had someone in there that's not entirely tacky.
It has, and this definitely comes back to this question that the big five who qualify automatically, do they actually try? Because they know they don't have to get through a semi-final. Also, they have, to be honest, they've all sent some pretty ropey things in the last few years, and they should hang their heads in shame about that. Now, this year, not only have they come back, you know, with this great song, great act, like, completely agree with Chris, it's just great the way the tune goes along. Also, as a geeky linguist, I am so happy that it's in Italian, because since they scrapped the language rule, everybody just sings in English. And honestly, some years I watch it going, another ballad in English.
Yes.
Whereas this, he's great, he's got his tune going along, and, you know, he drops in kind of phrases in other languages, he gets references into mindfulness, you know, it's a really nice kind of zeitgeisty song, so I think he will do very well indeed.
Do you think there's some sort of a shady underground power over in Italy that somehow just decided this year, actually, we really want to win it? We're really stepping it up now because we want this contest to be happening in Italy next time. And I've always thought secretly, Britain really doesn't want Eurovision. Do you think there are some countries that are just like, oh, we actually don't want this. This is just too much trouble. Not interested, thanks.
That's a whole other dilemma, right? I mean, Ireland basically had to stop winning because they just kept winning and winning and winning, and it was getting so expensive to host it all the time. Now you have this whole debate between, do you leave deciding who to send to a sort of a professional jury to the TV channel or whoever, or do you have a public vote? Because to be honest, often the public make terrible decisions as well.
Oh, goodness. That brings us on to a different topic.
I usually trust the jury more than the public. It's terrible to say, but that's true.
That's right.
I know,
if only
the jury had been voting for Brexit. And on that matter, how is Brexit going to impact this year's contest, though? Because there were a lot of internet hoaxes floating around that Britain wouldn't allow to be part of Eurovision anymore. I think they'd all forgotten that Australia and Israel have always, at least have been part of it for a few years now anyway. But is that going to have an impact as well? Is the anti-Euro sentiment enough to maybe stop people from really caring so much about Eurovision? I mean, probably not, but what are your thoughts on this?
The sad truth is we've done so badly in the last few years that even if there was a protest vote, I don't think anyone would notice. There might conceivably be a pro-British vote in those countries that don't like the EU. Maybe in Portugal and Greece and places with huge youth unemployment, people will say, go for it, Britain. But I don't think so. And now I just think it's going to tell against us, I'm sure.
It's been a while, Francis, hasn't it, since anyone really realistically looked at Britain and thought, oh, yeah, you're in with the chances. I mean, 20. Engelbert was a fairly low point.
Yeah, no, 20 years. 20 years. Katrina and the Waves.
The wonderful Katrina.
Yes, it was a great song. I remember.
Great song, yeah.
We had Andrew Lloyd Webber. It was 2009 with Jade Ewan, and she came fifth, and that was a good shout.
What makes the perfect Eurovision song then? The perfect Eurovision performance. What are the elements that people need to be keeping an eye on? I know I've already mentioned having a good all-rounded stage presence, but you know it's a lot more complex than that. It's a real scientific recipe. Fernando, what are some of your top picks?
I think you need an element of extra. For example, we have the Romanian entry this year, which, I mean, I know it's not going to win, and I know it's not perhaps the most fantastic song, but she knows how to yodel, and she is the only Romanian person that can yodel, according to my research. So you need to know something that others don't as well, in my opinion.
Okay, so Fernando's advice is learn how to yodel. Chris, what would your suggestion be to a future Eurovision king or queen?
Oh, write something stunningly good.
Write something stunningly good.
Yeah, so there isn't a formula, actually. People go on about this, but if you look back over the years, it's very often the one thing not to do is write something like last year, because people won't vote for that. Write something incredibly beautiful, and I think also sing it yourself. Very often the artist who wins has a song they've either co-written or something like that. Make something lovely.
Authenticity and originality,
and beauty.
You think is key. And beauty.
Make something good.
Mm. Mm. Francis?
Yeah, so I think Chris is right about the winners. I basically have terrible taste and I love all the like trashy novelty things like Romania's light up piano, Ukraine with their giant onstage spinny hamster wheel thing. I thought that is awesome. So basically if I like something, it's the kiss of death because it means that you've just gone all out on the special effects. So yeah, exactly, this year I'm excited about the yodeling, about the space guys, you know, all the wrong kind of things. So yeah, I probably just shouldn't answer that question lest I condemn some poor act's chances by giving them my endorsement.
The drinking games at Francis's house must be an absolute riot, though. I think your Eurovision parties would go off completely. Do you have an absolute pick then for your number one novelty?
Ooh, I love Greece had a trampoline one year. They had a hidden trampoline on stage and they suddenly just went like boing on it and came up. That was really great. One year in Norway, the guy had light up dreadlocks. I mean, that was a long time ago, but
dreadlocks?
Yeah, light up anything or like UV, you know, like they did that. The UK did that a couple of years ago. But because the song was dreadful, of course, we did dreadfully, but
well,
they did have a nice little, yeah.
no amount of light up novelties is going to save you from a dreadful song. All right, well then quickly then, we need to decide who we each want to win. This is your early vote. We're still a little way away from the actual contest itself. Tell us, who would you be pegging all of your hopes on? Fernando, I'll start with you.
I have to follow my heart because, cool, I want Italy to win. I think it's going to win. That's what I tell to serious people when they ask me, but I wouldn't mind, actually, if Montenegro plays a surprise and this guy with leather trousers, huge hair and tacky song. I hope Montenegro wins, actually, deep, deep, deep inside my heart. That's my answer.
Chris, what about you?
I do love Italy. I think it's a fab, so I will go for that. I love it. It's great.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm finding it difficult for my choice, and I'm going to save myself for last, Francis.
I actually really like Armenia this year. Earlier, when we were talking
card.
About people who try and like push the politics subtly, the last few years they've had a lot of like not subtle and not so subtle attempts to talk about the genocide. This year, they're not talking about genocide. They've just gone for a really great pop act. She looks a bit Kardashian-y. They have a really kind of catchy like bass hook, which I think that often works because it sticks in people's mind when it comes to the voting. So they've got a good song, glamorous hair, nice dance routine. I think Armenia's one to watch.
Wow, Armenia. All right, that adds something onto my list of things to keep an eye out for then. My hopes will definitely be on Italy as well. I think we've kind of just already decided that one, haven't we? All right, so let's move along then, because while all this music is taking place in Kiev, we were thinking that we might investigate what Ukrainians are actually listening to on a daily basis right now on the FM radio dials. Fernando, each week you do a bit of a global countdown where you pick a different country and talk us through its top five. So why not take us through what Ukraine has been listening to? And All right, I'll be honest. I can see the list in front of me and I can already see what number one is, and I'm not even going to mention that. Fernando, it's over to you. Where are we? Where do we start?
We're going to do a little countdown. The only sad thing, Ben, on the chart, the whole top five is not, there's no local artist there. Number six, it is Ukrainian singer Kisha. He tried to be the 2009 Eurovision entry for Ukraine, but he didn't manage to. So it's interesting that and their entry this year, I can totally understand why the Ukrainian entry is not in the top 40, because it's by O. Torvald with Time. It's quite a kind of a rock, pop rock ballad. I don't think there's nothing special with the song, so I understand Ukrainians are not listening to it on the radio. But shall we? I'll give you a little countdown.
Let's do it.
Number five have the British band Clean Bandit with Sean Paul and Anne-Marie with Rockabye.
I didn't know Sean Paul was still a thing.
He is still a thing. He loves doing these featuring songs.
Exactly. We all party like it's 2005 again.
Yes. I mean, let's be honest, Get Busy is quite a nice track.
Absolutely.
Shake that thing. You know, it's cool. Number four is LP. Other People. I didn't know much about LP. She's 36. She's from the US. She's kind of an indie singer. For some reason, she's very popular in Ukraine at the moment. And she wrote songs for Cher. So, I mean, that's a good thing, no?
I'd be putting that on my CV.
And number three, we have Rag & Bone Man with Human.
Rag & Bone Man on the Monocle 24 playlist as well.
And he's basically everywhere. You know, he's got this type of soulful tracks that people tend to like. Not exactly me, but yeah, people do like.
Not for Fernando, but lovely for other people.
Number two, we have Matthew Coma, Kisses Back. And again, very interesting about Matthew Coma. He's another American singer. But he's very, very popular in Eastern Europe. He's doing very well in Poland as well. And again, I think, artists sometimes they find their niche. And, you know, he's been touring all over Europe for quite a long time. Shall we play a little bit of the number one song?
I suppose we have to, don't we? Because we've built it up so much.
I'm in love with the shape of you. We push and pull like a magnet do. Although my heart is falling too. I'm in love with your body. Last night you were in my room, and now my bedsheets smell like you. Every day discovering something brand new. Well, I'm in love with your body.
Fernando, I remember looking at those music charts a little while ago and seeing Ed Sheeran everywhere. He's still there. Okay, I haven't looked again because I remember when that happened, it felt like I was in an episode of Black Mirror where all music had been replaced by Ed Sheeran, like there was something attached to my eyeballs. Let's just be thankful he's not been put forward to take part and represent Britain in Eurovision, because can you imagine that if he actually took over all of the places at Eurovision as well? Every time the scorecards came up, it was just Ed Sheeran, Ed Sheeran, Ed Sheeran for Russia.
By the way, there's a danger here. I don't know what you guys think, because last year we had Justin Timberlake playing in the middle of the show. And I remember when I was there in Stockholm, a lot of people were only talking about actually Justin Timberlake. I think it was kind of sad because it's kind of distracted people to the real song. So I'm kind of scared. Imagine they say, we have Ed Sheeran in the middle of the Eurovision. Like, no, please. I mean, leave it to the Eurovision artist.
Yeah, stick to your roots, I think. So, I mean,
it's an alright song, you know, but he's just being played so much.
It's also very formulaic, you know, saying, is there a formula to write a Eurovision winner? Well, there's certainly a formula to write an Ed Sheeran song, which is you get the blandest chorus, the blandest verse, you stick some really bland guitar chords on top, and it's like, snoozeathon.
Yes.
Snoozeathon. Well, on that note, we do need to wrap up. Fernando is, he's got to rush off and jump on a flight to Kiev. Our jet-setting Eurovision correspondent, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Just before I let you all go, though, I just wanted to maybe leave us all with one thought on what Eurovision will leave us talking about this year, whether it's a political thought or something about the music, something about the spirit of Eurovision. What do you think will be the end verdict that we'll come away with from this year's song contest? Fernando, why don't I throw you in the deep end and ask you for your analysis first?
I have to be honest, I actually loved the full lineup of this year's show. The last two or three years, I don't have the exact numbers, but I felt we had quite a lot of boring tracks. But this year, especially finally, I think the potential winner of the event is one of my favorites as well, which is the Italian entry. I think just the power of good songs. I think that's what we're going to have. And I love the fact that, you know, the event is back in Eastern Europe, and it's going to be my fifth year covering the event, so I think it'll be quite interesting to see as well Eastern Europe.
The power of good music to get us thinking about national borders in a bit of a different way. Overcome geopolitics, perhaps, just for a little while. Chris, what about you? What are your hopes for this year's contest?
Well, I think the big thing about this year's contest is the return of national languages. And I think that's wonderful. I love it. It's so nice to say the Italian and Portuguese entries are good. But there's lots of other countries singing in their own languages, and I think that's great.
Getting us to think about the international perspective of what Eurovision is all about. Yeah. And Frances, maybe leave us with your thoughts on hopes for Eurovision 2017.
I think that if Italy do win, which looks very likely, it would be nice that the big five would kind of be back and there wouldn't be anybody just turning up and phoning it in, that everybody would knew they had to send the best song, the best act, and really get into the spirit of it.
Standards, Europe, come on. Raise your bar. Thanks, everyone, for your thoughts on that one. And thank you, Fernando, because you're off to Kiev to report from Eurovision. So we'll speak to you again there once you touch down. And thanks to my guests today, Chris West and Frances Robinson. Chris's book, Eurovision, A History of Modern Europe Through the World's Greatest Song Contest, is out now, published by Melville House. Well, we've pushed the clocks forward a little bit now, so we're going to catch up with a few people behind the scenes. It's now Wednesday. Now, 2 years ago, we saw a first for Eurovision. As part of the 60th anniversary celebrations, Australia was allowed to take part in the competition. And I must say, we did pretty well, meaning that we got to return last year and we're coming back again this year as well. Now, over in Australia, Eurovision has always been a pretty popular television event, despite being at the wrong end of the international clock. It's been showing on the SBS network. It's actually been showing usually twice, once early in the morning and then once late at night for anyone that doesn't want to get up early on a Sunday morning. This year, its hosts are radio personality Miff Warhurst and the comedian Joel Creasy. Producer Holly Fisher spoke to Miff about what it means for Australia to be a permanent part of the contest and how you prepare to present such a mammoth evening of song and dance.
I can tell by your eyes you want more than this. But can we be much more beyond these sheets?
It's absolutely incredible. It's my first Eurovision, so not the first one I've watched, obviously, but it's my first time attending. And I don't know if you can imagine or think about what you think it's like and then times that by 7,000. It's just huge. It's a spectacle. There's people everywhere. The songs are big and, the voices are loud and the outfits are crazy. And, it's just loads of fun, actually. I'm really pleased to be here.
And it must be kind of a little bit of a shock to the system to go all the way to the other side of the world and land in this place full of so many colourful characters and all these colourful outfits. Is everyone in full Eurovision mode all the time?
Pretty much. Although, look, I've been really surprised, actually. We spend a lot of time backstage and it's really nice. All the entrants who are there are just hanging around like normal folk. It's very humble. I was surprised by that. I thought there'd be a lot of diva activity and, you know, entourages and that sort of thing. But it doesn't really seem like that. Even just the other day, it was pretty funny. Robin Bengtsson, who represents Sweden, you know, he's hotly to win the competition. Very stylish man. You know, you'd think he'd be quite unapproachable. Here he was just lining up for a sandwich to buy one backstage at catering. And I was like, this is a really great event. It's really human, but it's really extravagant at the same time. It's fascinating.
Eurovision was big in Australia before you even began entering it. How do Australians typically embrace and watch the show? Is it a big party day? I mean, I guess it's a bit of a weird one because it happens at the wrong time of day in Australia.
Yeah, you'd be so surprised. Eurovision has been broadcast, I think, since the 80s, back when Terry Wogan in the UK used to do the voiceover commentary. We've been watching it ever since then, and Australia is full of Eurovision obsessives, and I think this is how we ended up in the competition. It's basically something we've been doing. It's part of our blood. People get up early and watch the live feed, and then they'll repeat it late at night in the oncoming days if you want to watch it that way. But there's huge fandom for Eurovision here. People think of it like musical sport in Australia. And you know Australians love sport. So this is just the musical version.
So tell us a bit about your entry this year.
Oh, Isaiah. He's just adorable. He's 17 years old and he's got the most beautiful old soul voice. He's extraordinary. And he's also got a real sense of self that I certainly didn't have when I was 17. I was probably a bit of an idiot at that age. But he just really plays out and does his thing. And when he comes off stage, I shed a tear and give him a hug. And I'm like an embarrassing auntie. But he's from the Murray River area in Victoria, in Australia, and he has an Indigenous background, and he's really proud to represent Australia, not just for Australia, but also for the kids who are like him. He thinks that if you can see people doing what he's doing, then obviously it makes it easier for them to achieve equally great things. So he's representing many things, I think, for Australia in this competition, and we're all really proud of him.
This year's theme at Eurovision is diversity, and I think your act certainly celebrates that, being a gay male teenager from an Indigenous background. And it's quite an interesting theme to tackle in a country where, I don't know, being gay perhaps isn't quite as easy as in other places. From what you've seen so far, do you think they've tackled this well?
I think Eurovision will always deal with those issues anyway, regardless, because, I mean, last night, even if you think about the gorgeous performance by Montenegro, I mean, that was just the campest, most wonderful, outwardly gay performance I've seen in a long time. It was Eurovision, so that part's covered. But I do think here in Ukraine, they might have muddled it up a little bit, even down to the hosts. Everyone's kind of questioning a little bit when the theme is diversity. They've gone for three male hosts that pretty much have the same haircut except for one who's got the beard. I guess maybe the beard is diversity, but it's a little bit muddled here, I think, in terms of that. But they're certainly trying.
And we're just a few days away from the big finale. How are you and Joel preparing for it?
We shall prepare by, you know, taking in some of the sights of Ukraine, perhaps some of the drinks of Ukraine, because it is Eurovision after all. I think part of it is to actually really enjoy yourself as well. You've got to throw yourself in the deep end at something like this and get the most out of it. So I think that's what we'll be doing. We'll be taking in the sights and the attractions and the foods and just getting amongst it, I think, and just celebrating that whole spirit of the party.
Sounds like no bad thing. I think it's definitely the one commentating job that has to be done with a drink in hand.
Exactly.
What will you actually have to do on the actual night?
We will be doing the commentary, obviously talking in between the performances, not over them, a la Graham Norton, I think, in the UK. So we'll be tapping on his door. He's just a couple of doors down from us. But yeah, it's a similar thing. We'll be commenting, we'll be enjoying, we'll be critiquing, I think, trying not to be too catty, because, I mean, these people have worked really hard to get to this point. So there's a lot of joy for us to be able to do this. But it don't come easy.
That was Miff Warhurst, one of Australia's presenters of Eurovision this year. Now let's head backstage, where we'll find Fernando, who's landed safely and joined the Euro Club. He's catching up with maestro of all things Eurovision, William Lee Adams, who's been in Kiev covering the rehearsals for over a week already.
I arrived on April 28th, so about 2 weeks early. I haven't slept since then. It's been nonstop. You know, Eurovision is a musical circus meets the World Cup meets a beauty pageant. There are feathers, there's cleavage, there's a lot of music. I'm exhausted and I'm running on the fumes of televised spectacle, but I love every minute of it.
I have to say, you look good. Let me know the cream you're buying. But first of all, tell us about the schedule. Because, of course, the most famous events are both semifinals happening on Tuesday and Thursday and the big final on Saturday. But tell us about the preparation. What do you do in those weeks in advance?
I think for diehard Eurovision fans, the first week is almost more interesting because you see the evolution of acts. These acts arrive having not taken the stage, having not even seen the LED screens in some instances, and you see their stage show evolve from something oftentimes a mess into something really beautiful and emotional. It starts with just the wide shots of them working the empty stage, but then you see the camera cuts, you see the pyro, you see the fire. It really comes together in the most amazing way. You see how much could go wrong. On TV, when viewers watch, they see 3 minutes of perfection, Super Bowl-style staging, but so much goes into that, and that's times 26 in the grand final, times 42 when you look at all the songs that sing. So much goes into this. It's an amazing, amazing spectacle.
Tell us about the Euroclub. Again, not many people know, but it's potentially the most fun part of coming to Eurovision as well. I believe you host a party as well, so if you can tell us a bit more about that as well.
Sure. Euroclub is the center of fan activity when the sun goes down. Eurovision fans come together in a nightclub and they dance to Eurovision music, Europop, Eurodance. It's really one of the few places on Earth where you can go and be surrounded by thousands of other Eurovision fans dancing to Eurovision music. It's just a very rare event. This year it's been slightly different. I think the Ukrainian organizers have been running it more like a nightclub as opposed to a Euroclub. So you see scantily clad women hired by the club to dance on stage, essentially wearing strings. And it shows they haven't done their research into their audience, because Eurovision is very much an LGBT event on the ground, let's be frank. In this press room, I'd say that straight people are the minority. And there's nothing wrong with that. I myself am gay and have straight friends. Yeah, Euroclub is just a safe space to enjoy Eurovision music for people of all sexualities.
Tell us about the party you've hosted on Wednesday. Unfortunately, I couldn't attend, but I heard some of the artists were there as well.
Oh, thank you so much. It was off the hook. We had two parties, one on Saturday and one on Wednesday, and we featured, you know, tons of Eurovision 2017 acts. We had the Eurovision 2015 winner, Måns Zelmerlöw. We got to interview the acts on stage, because we spend so much time with the artists doing interviews. Earlier, we talked about the press schedule. It's so full on. You start rehearsing at 10 a.m., after each act, you have the interview, you have second run-throughs, you have press conferences. We're filming all of this, and it's so much mayhem, and it's, you know, 9 a.m. to 2 a.m., essentially. And the party is a way for us to share all the knowledge we've gathered with these contestants, with Eurovision fans who don't have access to the press room. So we bring the acts on stage, they perform, we do a little interview. You know, the Polish singer, she's been naked in Playboy covered by a wolf. We've got to talk about it.
Talking about being naked on Playboy, I'm just joking, but let's be a bit cheeky here. Have you seen any couples meeting during those weeks before Eurovision? Tell us about the love scene between Eurovision fans.
Oh, as at any club, there's love and there's hate. Relationships are born and relationships die. But what I love is that it fits with the theme of Celebrate Diversity, because most of these relationships are cross-border. You see the Portuguese guy with the Austrian lover. You see the Swedish woman with her Russian boyfriend. I've even seen a Russian-Ukrainian couple who met at Eurovision a few years ago. People are building bridges through Europop music, and I just love it.
I know you had some criticism, you know, with the behind the scenes of this year's event, but tell me, which one was a good one? So historically, you know, this is my fifth Eurovision, but I believe you've been many more times than me, so tell us.
It's interesting. Here in Ukraine, there was so much drama in the build-up to Eurovision, but now that we're here, things are running very smoothly. Perhaps it's that former Soviet efficiency, you know, back in the Soviet Union, or even other communist countries like Vietnam. If there's a hole in the road, you can fix it instantly. You deploy 20 people, done. And here, there's just a sense of things getting done. The stage looks beautiful. Everything's going on schedule. Perhaps because of all the drama before, they wanted to ensure that everything would run smoothly. So maybe that was a blessing that they had all that horrible headlines previously. I think Vienna ran very smoothly. I think the volunteers at Eurovision 2015 in Vienna knew how to help us. They were very enthusiastic. Interestingly, in Sweden, the volunteers were a bit robotic. Like, it's almost like they didn't want to be there. Perhaps it's not as special to Sweden because they win so frequently and they host so frequently. Whereas here in Ukraine, the volunteers are very enthusiastic, actually, and they watch our vlogs and blogs and they come to press and comment on the material we've been producing. It's very nice. It's very refreshing, because in Sweden, it was beautiful, of course, and everything worked, but it didn't have as much soul, I'd say, as Ukraine does. It means more to the Ukrainians.
That's a nice touch. And finally, William, what's your relationship with the artists? I mean, I want to know, do they also arrive around the 28th of April, by the end of April? You know, do you develop a relationship with them? Tell us a bit more.
So we've actually been following them as early as January at different parties. So usually once they're chosen, we have the first Skype interview with them on our website. And it's become part of the process or the cycle. So we've had dozens of interviews with some of the artists, and many of them are friends. The Albanian singer lives in Atlanta near my sister, funny enough. It's a very small world. And they message us on Facebook. They write us emails asking for advice and tips. So it goes beyond just reporting. We really do become quite close. And, you know, for instance, last night, Albania, she was at our party and she got eliminated in the first semifinal. She sang Whitney Houston's I Will Always Love You, and she broke down in tears. And she said, this is dedicated to all those fans who supported me because I do love you. And thank you so much, Weeby Blogs, for all the support you've given me. And it breaks your heart, because most people won't watch Eurovision until the final, but already so many people have fallen at the first hurdle. It breaks your heart.
That was William Lee Adams there, speaking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco in Kiev. And, well, Fernando, fittingly enough, joins me right now on the line. Fernando, you're in Kiev. It's Friday morning. Last night we had the semi-finals. Who has made it into tomorrow night's final competition then?
Well, Ben, I'm very happy to say that some of my favorites did go through. You know, the yodeling Romanians, which I think you know pretty well.
I do know that pretty well.
And Ben, you know, it comes, you know, because my worries with Eurovision is that those more kind of wacky entries, they wouldn't be able to go to the final because, you know, now there's the semifinals and people, they kind of want more professional singing, which yeah. sometimes can be a bit boring. Because,
I know,
because
you're quite a fan of the wacky Eurovision stars, aren't you?
Absolutely, but I'm very happy with the lineup in the end this year because we have, you know, some very strong ballads like Portugal. We have, of course, the favorite Italy, which is a fantastic song. But we also have some fun tracks like as I mentioned, the Romanian one or even the Belarusian one. I believe it's the first time they sing in their own language. It's the first Belarusian entry which is sang in their own language, which is another big trend on this year's Eurovision Song Contest, which I think is very welcoming because I don't think people want to hear all the songs in English.
No, absolutely not. They don't. We were chatting about that earlier in the show, actually, about the value of performing Eurovision tracks in your own language. And of course, it's so good to see Italy being a favourite this year with a song that's actually sung in Italian. That's really great news. But look, I want to get your tips as to who's going to win in just a moment. But first, can you just explain to me a little bit about what the mood is like over in Kiev? Because of course, we were a little bit concerned that, you know, with all the political tensions erupting around Europe at the moment, perhaps Eurovision wouldn't quite be able to bring its big carnival atmosphere to a city that's perhaps got other things on its mind. Are people getting into the Eurovision mood and embracing the contest?
I gotta be honest, Ben. Being in Kiev is different from the previous four Eurovisions, which have been, which were in Sweden, Denmark, and Austria. For example, as you can see, there's a large number of LGBT tourists, and I think the city is still not very comfortable with that. But having said that, you know, if you walk around the city, you do feel that Eurovision is in town. There's so many posters around. There's big banners in the major shopping centers. So I think at the same time, Ukrainians are happy. The events being hosted here. And I have something else to say, Ben. The security this year has been, my God, there's police officers everywhere. You almost feel kind of worried that there's too many of them. But perhaps it's for a good thing. But even when you come to the press center, there's so many checks on you. You have to show your pass all the time. I haven't seen that in previous Eurovisions as well.
Well, of course, the authorities in Kiev do tend to have a bit of a, well, shall we say, varied reputation. So hopefully that is going to be good news. That's probably a discussion for another day. But Fernando, back on to the finalists. Can we get your picks? Who is going to actually take away the big title?
Before I tell you who is one of my favorites, I have to say that there's another track by Israel, which I thought was quite fun. And the guy looks quite handsome. I think we need some handsome guys as well in the final.
Well, that certainly always can't hurt, can it?
Of course, but let's talk about the favorites. I think Portugal and Italy are the talk of town. Italy is still the favorite, but people are saying that Portugal do have a very strong chance to win. But if you know, I think I have a song of my choice here, and I like to play a little bit left field because I think the Moldovan entry was really a surprise for me. I thought it was fun. It was a bit kind of wacky because it was like three brides with a bouquet that transforms in a microphone. And there's kind of this electronic beat that I like as well.
Well, Fernando, that sounds like a winning recipe indeed.
Of course.
All right, so we definitely know who to keep an eye on then when the Eurovision final does finally take place on Saturday night at 8 o'clock London time. Do check your local listings wherever you happen to be listening. I'm sorry to say that if you are an avid fan over in Australia, you're going to be getting up quite early indeed. But don't worry, it will be repeated on SBS as it is every year anyway. Fernando Augusto Pacheco in Kiev. Do enjoy the song contest. We'll leave you there for now. This show was produced by Holly Fisher and researched by, well, none other than Mr. Eurovision himself, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again at the same time next week. But for now, here is Fernando's choice for Eurovision. This is Sunstroke Project with Hey Mama. My name's Ben Rylan. Thank you for listening.
Hey, hey you, you will never hide but to think of me. I see.